Hello and welcome to Fusion, a show for Relay FM members where I talk to hosts from various shows about a single topic. My name is Stephen Hackett, and this month I'm joined by David Smith of Under the Radar.
Hello.
Hey. Hey.
Hello.
David's here.
Yes, that's me.
He's very excited. We're also joined by Dan Morin of Clockwise. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Stephen. I guess I'm not as excited as David, but I'm still pretty excited.
Pretty excited. So we, as we're recording this, we're just a month away from Apple's WWDC keynote, the first WWDC that will be all online, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. And it seems like a really good time to talk about maybe some things that we want to see, some things we expect to see. I'm just going to throw this wide open. I did want to start, though. David, you wrote this really excellent blog post about watchOS 7. I think there's honestly very few people outside of Apple that know watchOS as well as you do. Honestly, you probably know it better than many people within Apple at this point. So that'll be in the show notes. Go check that out. But I was wondering if you could kind of give us a high level of what you would like to see on the watch, and then we can go from there.
Sure. I mean, I think the big things that I'm kind of, when I think about where watchOS 7 is going to go, like it feels like I just want to keep seeing big progress on this platform, that it feels like the hardware underlying the devices at this point is pretty robust. Even at, like, if the baseline became, say, the Series 3 Apple Watch, it's a very robust device on a hardware side. And I just want to keep seeing Apple push that platform forward. Like, so some years, you know, I feel like so often what we at WWDC, there's some years where it's like big new changes, lots of cool stuff, and then some years there's not. And my big hope with watchOS 7 is that they sort of keep pushing that platform forward and, you know, sort of seeing what's possible there. And I think there's so many things there, like in terms of sleep or recovery tracking, that they could do on the health side, potentially increasing what they do on the sort of on the mental health side, increasing flexibility that third-party developers like I do, that I am, have with things like complications and what the watch looks like, which I think is even more so like important in a world of always-on watch faces, like making your watch face look like something that you care about and like and is personal to you. It feels like even more of an important thing now, and maybe there were some things they didn't want to kind of like do last year because it would kind of tip their hand that the always on display was coming. But hopefully this year, like my hope is that there's a lot of things where it kind of, it makes the current generation of always on watch hardware, like, make a lot more sense and be more robust and useful. And so, like, I think those are the big things that I'm kind of seeing. And then it's just sort of like continuing to round out, a lot of their offerings, you know, adding more workout types, adding more capabilities and functionality to the device more generally.
The watch has been on such an interesting journey to think that it really hasn't been all that long since it was introduced, but how much change it's really seen. I mean, it really felt like a scattershot approach, at least in messaging early on. It's like, oh, it'll replace your phone, it'll do this and do that. And as they've honed in on people want fitness and notifications, I feel like it's become a device and a platform that makes a lot more sense to a lot more people. But I agree with you, they got to keep it moving.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to see, I mean, as David's saying, like, looking to see them taking big swings at stuff and sort of trying, like, what can we do to push this forward? Because I think in a lot of ways, the path for the watch has at times been very clear in terms of the kind of things that need refinement, the kind of things that need improvement. Like, a lot early on when there was, like, low-hanging fruit, right? Like, stuff that was, quote-unquote, missing. You're like, oh, well, I'm looking forward to add this thing that should have been there at the start or whatever. But as the watch has become more and more robust in and of itself, I think the challenge has become, all right, how do we push this envelope? How do we make this do more, but without losing that kind of focus that we have before? Because you could very easily end up back in a situation as they were when they originally introduced the watch, where it's like, we try a little bit of everything, and none of it's great. Mm-hmm. And that's a risk. What you want to do is take those big swings at sort of the stuff that's right in your wheelhouse. Like, oh, it's fitness. Like, how do we push fitness forward? How do we push notifications forward? And so I thought David's list was excellent. There's a lot of great stuff in there. And I'm really interested to see, it's always tricky with the development cycle, but part of me wonders, you know, over the last 3 months, a lot of us have probably, our relationship with our Apple Watch has changed a lot. And I include, you know, I'm sure all the people who are working on developing that as well as executives at Apple. And I'm kind of curious to see if that changes any of the ways that they're thinking about things. I mean, again, I know it's so late in the development process that a lot of this stuff is probably locked down by them, but it is interesting to see how our relationships have changed. I mean, David pointed out the idea of like rest days. And I think like, you know, that's been a big thing. I think in terms of people dealing with activity when they're at home now or what have you, like being able to be more flexible about things or adapting to the way that circumstances are now. So I'm kind of curious to see if there's any impact from that whatsoever.
Yeah, and I think along those lines too, I see it's like the funny things that I think about where like so much of where Apple had been pushing the Apple Watch had been towards independence and separation mm-hmm. from the iPhone. Mm-hmm. And like that was a big push. And I think it's an important push, but it's a funny thing in the current context. Just because like my Apple Watch has not been away apart from my iPhone for a long time
right.
At this point. Like that's just not the world we live in right now. Like I'm not leaving the house. And so my watch is always on the same Wi-Fi network as my phone. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if that changes anything in terms of their priorities, but it certainly is interesting as a context, just sort of where these features are and what they're going to be.
In terms of other stuff that we're thinking about, I think the biggest thing that's probably on a lot of our minds, especially as people who, you know, closely follow Apple, is this rumored processor transition, right? Like, is that something, is it happening on this time scale? I think we all feel like it's going to happen. It's just a question of when. And I guess the question now is it when? Is when now? Yeah. Something like that. I don't know how you phrase that. If only I were a writer. But I think a lot of people are excited about the possibilities that come along with that kind of transition in terms of moving the Macs from Intel chips to Apple's own custom design chips, because we've seen so much of what's possible with the iPhone and the iPad and even the watch, the AirPods, right? All this other stuff that has custom Apple silicon in it. And we're sitting there going like, man, like what could you do with a Mac that has these kinds of like really, really custom design chips in them? Could you get a lot more power of them? Could you get a lot more battery life? Could you get both? Like, could you make them, you know, thinner, et cetera? Like, I just think it's intriguing to see where that goes. Apple is a company that has, you know, certainly no stranger to processor transitions. And so they've, you know, arguably had more practice at it than any other company on the market. And I'm very excited by the possibility of that. And it feels like kind of, you know, it harkens back to the transition to Intel in terms of like, oh man, now that we've, you know, kind of moved away from the PowerPC processors, this opens up all these possibilities for us, especially on the portable side, right? Like the laptops on the portable side at the end of the PowerPC era were really being held back by mm-hmm. what was possible in a portable form factor. So again, you know, Intel, I think, makes great chips, but it's not doing exactly what Apple needs to do. And if Apple can sort of do the whole widget, there is a lot more possibility there. So that's something I'm interested to hear more about. I've got my fingers crossed.
Yeah, and I think what's really interesting there is the story about how that's unveiled, if it does come. Like, if, because there's inevitably with a processor transition, there's going to be a sort of, there's the developer side of that, and there's the customer side of mm-hmm. that. That the, you know, as a developer making Mac software, there's certain things that developers will need to change in order to, you know, best take advantage of a new processor, whether that's necessarily a requirement. You know, it seems very likely there's going to be some kind of emulation layer or thing that they've done before, so that there isn't this like everything has to be completely rebuilt mm-hmm. from the ground up for the new OS, but or for the new processor. But I think how they roll that out is going to be kind of interesting. Like in terms of, I'm just kind of get stuck on, do they introduce that this is something that's coming and talk to developers and try and have this fall, we're going to be introducing Macs that support this, or is it going to be, you know, here's the new Macs that support this, you guys better rush and hurry up and mm-hmm. get working, because you kind of have this weird effect where if you pre-announce that, you know, say new Macs are coming with ARM processors and they're going to come out this fall or next spring or whatever that timeline is, it puts all the, you know, the Macs, the classic kind of like the Mac sales between now and then, get in this really weird place of like, is it worth waiting until the new amazing, you know, stuff comes out, or should I, you know, if I'm in the market to buy a MacBook Air and there's going to be an ARM MacBook Air that's going to come out in 3 months, like it puts it in a weird place. I'm very curious also to see how they message that, or if they just go for it. And I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if they just announce here's the new hardware and there's a emulation layer for right now, and if developers do the work to, you know, to sort of rebuild and to sort of take advantage of the new hardware, then more stuff will happen. But it feels, that feels more natural to me. But I think sort of WWDC is certainly an interesting place for them to make that announcement, because a processor change for many customers will make no difference. That's like obvious, and you know, it's like it won't look any different or feel any different. It might just be faster and have better battery life. But from a developer perspective, it's a much more sort of big deal. And you know, you can imagine many sessions and discussions about how to sort of how best to deal with that as a developer.
I wonder too what the Mac line will look like once we're into this process. So when the switch from PowerPC to Intel, the iMac and the MacBook Pro were first, like you said, the notebooks were in such sorry shape, they had to have an Intel notebook. But that came, you know, 6 months after they announced the transition, and they had that transition, like, developer hardware. I don't think they would do that again.
Well, I mean, you know, the argument that our friend Jason Snell has made is like, well, if you've got an iPad Pro sitting there that's essentially powerful enough, could that be a dev kit in some way, right?
Like,
They've already got the hardware.
I think I've hopped onto that conspiracy train pretty hard.
It's a good, I mean, it makes a lot of sense when you think about it, right? Like, it's not, in Intel, that was a case where you were moving from stuff that Apple had kind of a hand in with the PowerPC chips to a, you know, pure third-party play. So, of course, they needed something. Like, this is all in-house. Like, in theory, they've already got machines that are essentially running this. Like, could they just make an iPad Pro able to install macOS? It doesn't seem out of the question, certainly.
Yeah, or of course, one thing if you want to go farther down the conspiracy rabbit hole.
Yes, I do. Thank you,
why,
David.
Why would you limit it to the iPad? Why is there any reason that if that's the case that you don't also allow people to install it on iPhones?
Oh man,
I mean, iOS. I mean, I know they call it iPad OS at this point, but like, come on, why not? Like, it's the same thing, and obviously, like, they can limit it kind of externally. But you got to imagine someone's going to figure out how to jailbreak or deal with that if they can't. And I mean, how wonderful is that you could run, you know, Mac OS, you know, with a Bluetooth keyboard and mouse, just like sitting there running on your iPhone? Like, why not? Like, that seems awesome and delightful and terrible all at the same time.
It's the Wild West, right? And
there's not enough of that these days. That's the thing. Like, you know, computing does not feel like it did 15 or 20 years ago, where everything was like, oh man, let's just push the envelope on this and see what we can do. It's become such a fact of life, just a hard fact of life, that we use our technology for things that, you know, I do think that sometimes we have lost a little bit of that joy, at least for me, like, as someone who doesn't make it as far as like a developer who's out there writing stuff, but is kind of like on the line between, you know, consumer, a prosumer, if you will, like right in the middle there. And I love the idea of having sort of a new frontier to play with.
The Intel transition, they said it, I forget what they initially said. I'll have some links in the show notes about the Intel transition, but basically they did it way faster. They did it within about 8 months, and the Xserve and the Mac Pro were last. They were the Xeon ones. Maybe that needed a little more time. Maybe Pro customers were less willing to make the jump. I remember I was around during these days paying attention to the Mac, and I remember there being people who couldn't go to Intel if they had like really custom audio or video solutions that weren't ready. And so they got held on. There were a bunch of G5s like as production machines for a long time. So I do wonder what the high end of the Mac would look like, assuming they have ARM chips that can match, you know, something like the iMac Pro or the Mac Pro. And
that's a real question, especially because the Mac Pro is so new, right? Like, it's hard to imagine that, you know, come this December, they'd be like, we've got a new Mac Pro that's built on our own processor.
Yeah.
It's like, that doesn't seem likely.
No. I think this will be a longer game than the Intel Switch. And really, if you look at the desktops, yeah, there's some issues with, you know, like, especially like the Xeon Ws, they're not refreshed very often. Like, what's going on with the iMac Pro? But to come back to the point we keep making, boy, the notebooks, like, you've got to focus on that. And that's the majority of Macs they sell, right? By far, it's the notebooks. Yep. And so you could almost leave, you know, the high-end desktops on Intel for a while. And I think those customers would be fine with that. I keep updating them, you know, but I think it'd be fine to split the line for a while. and, you know, move the Mac Mini and the iMac over, but maybe leave the Pro desktops on Intel for a bit. I don't think many people would complain too much about that.
It feels very in like the modern Tim Cook era, like leaving a computer on sale for a very long time after it was originally introduced seems very plausible and consistent that like their solution is just like, okay, that's fine. If you need an Intel for some, you know, Intel Mac for some reason, that's great. We'll keep selling one for like 7 years after, you know, like after the transition has happened, and that like they seem more than happy to just sort of keep things lingering around at the bottom list of their sort of their offering. And that, you know, like I think about some of the, even just some of the more recent Macs where that, you know, how long it was that there were certain, what was it? There was that education MacBook.
Oh yeah.
That just like, yeah. It just never died. Like it was there, like everything had moved past it. It was still non-Retina, I think. And it had just like, there's this one version.
It was holding down that price point, like under $1,000 basically for a long time.
And like,
And it's interesting too. I mean, this doesn't, not to muddy the waters, but like there was at some point in the last 6 months or so also like a whole rumor about AMD and like whether Apple was looking at AMD chips too. Like who knows, like at this point, what the lineup might look like, you know, come 6 months from now or so.
But I do kind of like the thought too, though, of how relatively small the Mac is in terms of the actual number of processors they would have to make to like, it's not one of these situations where they have to like ramp up production,
right?
In like, oh, it's this brand new processor, and they have to like really ramp it up. Like the number of processors they make every day for iPhones, like is probably like in one day they could make 6 months worth of Mac processors. And so, or even to that story, it's like if the way they build the Mac is, it's like it has three A13s in it, like. Sure, that's fine. Like that, they're not going to be like handicapped in that way. That I think is also kind of would make this transition a sort of speedy and smooth one.
So, what about the iPhone and iPad? This would be assumedly the second year of iPad OS. We've already seen Apple this year improve it. We got cursor support and a point update, which I don't think many people expected. So, I think all of us think that they will continue to move iPad OS and iOS further apart, but what would y'all like to see on that front?
Well, the biggest thing that iPad OS needs is they need to take another stab at multitasking, and they've tried a few times now, and it just hasn't really worked. And I think they're you know, they wanted to create a new paradigm, right? Like they had this issue where it's like, we've got this device, it is not a Mac, and it's fundamentally something that can do all the things that your Mac can do, but we're going to do it in a way that's more natural for the operating system, the interface, etc. But we've now moved back to having a keyboard and trackpad available, and so, you know, as a laptop, you know, you use the iPad and the Magic Keyboard or a keyboard case or something like that, and it's like you're like 80-90% of the way to like the Mac experience. You can certainly do a lot of stuff with it, but it does feel like as soon as you want to start using multiple apps, it's like I am in a weird bizarro world where like I can use this app but only over here, and I have to slide this other pane over and all that. And it feels like, didn't we solve this problem already like 30 years ago? So for me, I think the biggest thing I'd like to see them do is really kind of nail down like, what is our multitasking strategy? Like, can we focus it a little bit more? Because right now it does have that, has a little bit of what we talked about with the watch, where it's like, let's try to do a whole bunch of different things, and it gets confusing. Like you have to drag icons here and there all over. It feels like it's holding people back. And so I think that's, for me, on the iPad side, that's the biggest thing. On the iPhone side, it's a little harder. I mean, the iPhone is such a mature product now. I'd like to see them, again, sort of take a stab at refreshing stuff that's been stagnant for a long time. So there are some rumors about a home screen refresh, and it definitely feels like that could have come any time in the last 5 years, but now it feels really overdue, like just using a grid of icons. It's simple, I get it, but most people know how to use an iPhone now or a smartphone of any variety. So being able to mix that up a little bit more for power users to like have some widgets or rearrange icons or not have to have like folders and folders and folders on your last four home screens. I really feel like it's time for them to take a look at that.
Yeah. And I think I think what you're saying about the iPad and multitasking, I think what's going to be very interesting is to see if they're if they do go in a direction of kind of updating multitasking, is whether it's informed by their first party support of like external pointing devices now. Mm-hmm. That like for a while, in the last update where we had like they where pointing support became an accessibility feature, and it was this thing that was kind of like it was introduced in iOS 13, and it was like, this is interesting. Like, I wonder, is this going to stay as an accessibility feature? Is that their way of kind of bringing it to the platform, but not like fully embracing it? And then obviously it turned out that was just like them testing the waters before like full blown trackpad support, like on first party hardware. And it feels like if they are going to do a new swing at multitasking, making, you know, pointing support for that be something that is like fundamental, or at least like feel very natural, feels like this obvious thing where that sort of would be the next logical step in this progression that they seem to be on, that whatever their multitasking story is, it should be make even more sense in a world where you have a high precision pointing device available to you, and you can use that on the iPad. I expect they'll continue to keep it like it's touch first with sort of pointing second, but it's a different world where that's a officially supported, encouraged behavior than in a world where you sort of any kind of external pointing device support was always kind of this side thing that didn't really fit with the main use of the device. So I think that's going to be a very interesting thing, both in terms of now we have two high precision input devices, first party on the iPad, and with the Pencil and the trackpad. So like, I think that's going to be very interesting to see how they do that. And I'm certainly encouraged by what they did with pointing support, because they didn't just put a cursor on the, you know, on the screen. Like they really did the hard work to rethink what that could mean if you had to have a cursor in a touch first environment. And you know, I'm hopeful that they would take that same thoughtfulness and apply it to, well, where does multitasking really go on this device that's kind of straddling these two worlds? And you know, sort of, I think it's going to be interesting to see. And like, they keep trying it, and eventually they're going to find something that sticks. Like, that seems hopefully inevitable at some point.
Let's talk a little bit about the event itself. Like we said, this is the first online-only WWDC. Over the last several years, they've really ramped up the ability to follow along at home with live streams, having videos up very quickly. Of course, way back in the day, you had to order your WWDC sessions on tape or on DVD, and then for a while, they'd be like,
sure,
well, they'll be online some point in the summer, and now it's very quick. So I feel like they're pretty well prepared from the technical side of it. David, as someone who has gone for a really long time as a developer, you know, Dan and I go, we just hang out, right? We're just making podcasts and goofing off. But you're going for, as an actual developer, as you're supposed to. How do you think about those changes? What are you anticipating being different this year?
Sure. So, I mean, I think that there's a lot of open questions. And I think what I think is most exciting about this year is that it's their kind of... my first WWDC was in 2009, and so I've been going, I've been going for over a decade, and all of my years of going have always kind of been in the post iPhone era, which I feel like there was a different feel and a different structure, at least from what I hear from people who went before, when it was a bit more, when it was in the pre iPhone days. But in the current format, they've kind of settled into this very sort of strict, predictable structure where Monday morning there's the sort of the public keynote, then Monday afternoon there's the sort of developer state of the union, and then throughout the week they have technical sessions where there's a presentation, sort of a keynote presentation that someone gives with a few demos, and then typically there's a, you know, sort of related to those, there'll be a collection of labs where developers can go and get help or talk to engineers and get a bit more detail. And then, you know, there's all the kind of accessory events that they have fitness events or music or things like that. But the primary kind of structure is you have these two keynotes, the public and the technical on Monday, and then you have technical sessions, and then you have the labs. And that's like the core WWDC experience. And taking that online, like all of the presentations feel like that's a very natural, easy thing that they can do, that I kind of expect we'll have the sort of public keynote. And then I think what's going to be interesting is kind of, this is the question that you run into with like Netflix and Amazon Prime and things these days, where like, do they drop all the videos at once? Are they going to let us like binge watch WWDC? Or is it going to be, they're going to like measure them out throughout the week somehow for some reason, so that it can kind of fit that model or tie into how they're actually going to end up doing labs. You know, I think it's going to be an interesting choice of sort of a thing that they do there, because on the one hand, what's kind of nice about this format is they don't necessarily have to keep to these big, long, typically like 50-minute presentations that they've been doing previously in past years. Like, I could imagine a world both where it's logistically simpler in terms of, you know, getting the engineers and having the quality be good and doing the actual recording and editing, to have lots of more highly focused presentations this year, where there's like, this is this new feature, and it, you know, if it's an easy feature, it's here's like the 6-minute video about it, or if it's a big complicated thing, it could be, you know, an hour and a half long or whatever it is, but they can make that fit the subject matter rather than necessarily just based on fitting a schedule. And then I think what they do with labs and kind of developer relations is just going to be fascinating. Like, I don't know how they can, because, you know, in a normal WWDC, there's about, you know, maybe 5,000 attendees, and the labs are busy, crowded, have long lines, and are sort of useful and wonderful as a developer when you finally get to the front of the line and can talk to an Apple engineer. But I can't imagine that scales to like millions of engineers all around the world in all time zones. Like, I don't know what they're going to do about that. Like, they've made some references that there'll be something sort of equivalent to labs, and I don't know if that's going to be like some kind of forum system, or, you know, but like, I can't imagine it's like, get in virtual line behind, you know, 10,000 other people, and there's some poor Apple engineer at the other end who's trying to like have Zoom calls with all of us. Like, that just doesn't seem practical. But I think from a content delivery purpose, and like the core goal of WWDC from Apple's perspective seems to be, you know, communicate and make the developer community excited about the new stuff so that they spend that summer adopting whatever the cool new direction and sort of whatever the story is that Apple has for the year, that the developer community embraces it and moves it forward. And I think most of that communication and sort of excitement stuff can be handled just as well virtually. And then, you know, the way they deal with a sort of individual communication and update, like, I don't know. I don't envy them in that position, but I imagine this kind of like, they'll do their best. And if it's not as good as it could have been previously, if you were in person, like, that's okay. But it also has the benefit of, rather than only being limited to 5,000 people who won the lottery, it's open to, you know, the millions of developers all over the world.
Yeah. I mean, access is a huge part. And I think that is sort of the big win for everyone here, is the fact that developers don't need to not only win the lottery, but then have the money to pay for it, have the money to pay for travel and lodging and all of that. Like, it's expensive. I think that having that information just easily accessible and everybody's sort of on a level playing field is great. But the two things that you can't easily replicate with this kind of model are the labs, as Dave was saying. I think that's going to be a really big question. I think, honestly, Apple would be better served by trying to find a way to improve that year-round, basically, rather than shove it all into 1 week where it's just so limited by time. I would definitely, if I were them, be thinking about how can we sort of make this more of a thing that's not a once a year, like, oh, I finally get to talk to the Apple engineer who can help me solve this stupid problem. Mm-hmm. Like, I know so many developers who've been like, it's great to have that access, but it sucks that you have to wait like a year basically to get your opportunity, unless you know, happen to have contacts or what have you. The other flip side of it is, you know, as Steve was saying, like, you know, we all go for the culture and the community aspect. And I think, you know, there certainly will be opportunities to partake in, you know, lots of discussion about this online, and I'm sure there'll be lots of podcasts and all that stuff, but it's not the same, right? Like, most of us don't get a chance to see each other, or, you know, developers who are, you know, maybe new to the scene don't get a chance to meet new people, or developers don't get a chance to make new contacts. Like, that aspect is really difficult, if not impossible, to replicate online. For that reason, you know, I'm hopeful that at some point in the future, physical WWDC will be a thing again. But I can also see from Apple's perspective why, you know, the fact they feel like they can reach so many more people via online method, and it's probably a lot cheaper. I can understand why they would be enthused about doing it that way, in the same way that they eventually dropped out of, you know, Macworld Expo years ago, because they're like, we can reach more people through our Apple stores. And it's like, yeah, hard to argue with that fact, right? Like, those of us who liked going to those keynotes, you know, really miss it, but it didn't really hurt them in any way. So I think everybody, you know, Google, Microsoft, all the big companies are dealing with how does this change that aspect of their culture and their development community. And this year, we're going to see a lot of experiments, and we're going to see some that don't work very well, and we're going to see some that maybe work better than what we used to have. And seeing what kind of comes out of that, I'm fascinated. I am fascinated. And you know, I don't think this will probably increase the number of WWDC sessions that I consume. You know, every year I watch or go to one or two, depending on whether or not I've had a badge. And I've been going since, I think, 2007. You know, I think it's great that that information is there, but it also reminds me that I'm not a developer and that information is not very useful to me. I think it's really interesting. I don't think this is something Apple necessarily would have chosen to do, but, you know, sometimes that's a good thing. It gets them out of their comfort zone.
I didn't even realize this. Y'all are both on shows that last less than 30 minutes an episode.